The G7 heads of state meet in glorious Cornwall in the UK this week, with climate change and COVID likely to be high on the agenda. The discussions and decisions they make could impact the global economy and with it, the chemical industry in this time of crisis. I'm Will Beecham, and also in this week's podcast, what does the court ruling against Shell mean for oil companies and downstream chemicals in the medium to long term? And why should rising inflation matter for chemical companies? With me to discuss these important topics, I'm joined by Paul Hodges, Chairman of New Normal Consulting, Nigel Davis, our Insight Editor, and John Richardson, ICIS Senior Consultant for Asia. So, the G7 meets in Cornwall this week with the battle against climate change high on the agenda. And ahead of the meeting, BASF CEO Martin Brudermüller has given an interview today published in the Financial Times, where he warns that Europe may fall behind the US and China in the race to decarbonize. He says that BASF will not be able to meet its climate objectives unless it can access more renewable energy in Europe, and urges a more flexible approach to planning legislation. The CEO of Siemens is also quoted, saying the region's only installing in renewables at half the rate it needs for the targets it has set. Nigel, can I ask you, what sort of role do you think renewable energy can play in carbon reduction in the chemical industry?
Well, I mean, it's essential, it's pivotal in terms of how the industry decarbonizes. We've talked about this before, but you need electricity is the power source that you need, green electricity, to help drive the biggest reductions really in decarbonisation of steam crackers and other reactions that require any sort of heat to drive them. And also, I mean, what we're looking at really is some massive investment required by not just the European chemical industry, but the chemical industry generally around the world to actually decarbonize, to sort of, you know, and also a number of new alliances as well. You can imagine chemical companies teaming up with energy companies too, to actually secure supplies of renewable power. But as I said, you know, we need a clear guidance, particularly here in Europe from the EU, as to exactly what sort of targets are being set, and also incentives and some support really in terms of the enormous sums of money that are needed to actually achieve the targets that the EU, remember the revised targets that the EU has set itself in terms of carbon reduction or CO2 reduction. So therefore, you know, when are we going to get that sort of those assurances or those plans? When are we going to know what's going to happen? And also, how are we actually going to fund this? This is going to be, and that's critical. That's why Martin Brudermüller was talking as head of CEFIC this morning. So I saw the article in the Financial Times, but also power generators too. You know, how are we actually going to achieve this? And I think the point was being made that perhaps if we don't take action soon, we're going to sort of slip behind the rest of the world, really, and certainly slip behind China and the US in our bid to tackle climate change.
Well, Nigel, what do you think of new technologies such as electric crackers powered by renewable energy? Do you think they've got a future for the chemical sector?
Well, again, you know, they're key to the reduction for the emissions reduction by the upstream chemical industry. You know, that's we need those electric furnaces, and of course we've got the big players. You know, the Dows, the Shells, BSFs, and that all working on this quite hard. We haven't got the technology yet, but again, you know, we need some sort of support's the wrong word, but some clear guidance on where we're going in terms of legislation, where we're going to get the money from, and how we're actually going to achieve this.
Thank you. Paul, related to this, you've published a piece on your blog by a colleague which analyses the real impact of the ruling against Shell last week in a case brought by Friends of the Earth and other NGOs. Can you sum up what the judge ruled and why this is important for Shell and other oil and chemical companies?
Yeah, indeed. It is critical, especially if you take it in line with the IEA saying we don't need any more fossil fuel investment after this year, and then also what happened, the shareholder revolts at ExxonMobil and Chevron. Just to comment on what Nigel was saying, I think that the answer to the funding question is going to be the 1.7 trillion euro green recovery plan, which is now out with the member states for, you know, they're putting together their plans. Some of them are already submitting them, and that should be announced at the beginning of next month. So I think that's where the money will be around. And I think that's why Bruno Müller made his speech. I think it's very good timing there, just to remind people, you know, as you're finalising your plans, don't forget you've got a lot of spend money here. And if we come back, it all fits, you see, now with what Shell was saying, because Shell were told by the judge, look, you are a Dutch company, you have to abide by Dutch law and on climate change, because the climate is a global issue, your global operations have to abide by Dutch law. And it's no good. I mean, Shell made the comment, oh, you know, it's about government, it's not. And they said, no, your emissions are 3% of the world total. That's more than the Netherlands themselves. So you are a very important actor in reducing your emissions. So, and they were told they have to reduce their emissions by 45%, so nearly half, by 2030 relative to the 2019 levels. And interestingly, what they were also told was you can't appeal against this and do nothing for the 3 or 4 years that it takes. You have to implement now whilst you appeal. So in other words, you know, we know how court cases go in this area. It gets appealed to a higher court. It gets, you know, it ends up with the Supreme Court in 5 years' time. Well, that's going to be 2026. Over those 5 years, no matter what the final decision is, Shell are going to have to implement this decision. Now, I think myself, or we think, that Shell will look back on this moment as a really positive moment, because Shell, after all, are a company who have evolved incredibly successfully over the last 200 years. I don't know whether I can say this phrase, but Marcus Samuel, the founder of Shell, started life selling seashells on the Strand. I did it. That's good. And so he started on that in 1833. He then changed into transporting them around. Then when oil came along, because he was Shell Transport and Trading, he got into oil and they became the big company that we know and love today. So I don't think there's really much problem in Shell's DNA from saying, OK, we know intellectually that the days of fossil fuels are over. We've already discussed that. Now we actually had the kick up the whatever to say, right, now we have to go and do it. And, you know, there are obviously in every company, there are people who say, oh, no, I think we should just do what we're doing. Well, that's an impossible argument now. They can't stop you doing it now because the court has said you've got to do it. And if, you know, if I was Shell, I'd say, right, that's what we've got to do. And let's get that 45% reduction, the industry standard. You know, let's take that to COP26 and, you know, everybody do that. And then, you know, the die is cast. You know, people who are still doing something else are, you know, essentially trying to sort of sell coal when the world, you know, as they did, the coal was left in the ground and the oil and gas is going to be left in the ground.
Thank you, Paul. John, what sort of commitments do you expect or hope that the G7 political leaders could make, say, in the battle against COVID, for example, by boosting immunisation in emerging economies?
Well, I mean, it's costing emerging economies about $1 trillion a year. Well, the developed economies, Canada, Australia, the UK, US, have bought more vaccines than they need, even assuming, you know, people have received the second vaccinations. Canada in particular, actually. So we need to think about now how we fund these vaccinations for the developing world, maybe through special drawing rights through the IMF. I mean, the positive thing is that even Gordon Brown and Tony Blair are getting on in the G7 meeting. A lot of the world leaders have signed a letter to try and commit to this, solving this problem. Because until everyone is vaccinated, nobody's vaccinated. That's the issue. 2% of Sub-Saharan Africa has been vaccinated. And, you know, how those developing countries can meet their climate commitments under COP26 when they're facing this enormous crisis. I just don't know. They're going to really struggle because they've got, you know, bigger priorities. So we've got to get those vaccinations out to the developing world. Absolutely key. So early signs are good. You know, that there will be some action now. It's very slow. It's not just getting the vaccines to the developing world, it's distributing them. The problem is not enough nurses. Roads are a problem we can't fix, but we've got to increase those vaccination rates. And then the climate issue might be something they can address, perhaps, at COP26, but there's a risk that they won't be able to meet their commitments at that meeting.
Yeah, well, let's hope there's some action later this week on that front, John. And in your blog this week, you've also been taking another look at inflation. Well, lots of factors are pointing to the risk of price inflation. Consumers seem to want to spend on new cars, electronic goods, home improvements. But disrupted supply chains mean shortages of building materials, laptops, and rising used car prices. And shortages of microchips for cars and electronics, and chemical markets starved of material. So supply is just not keeping up with demand, it seems to me. And in this environment, prices tend to rise. But what does this mean for chemical markets? Does it matter if raw materials prices are rising, so long as these can be pushed through to customers? John, can I get your views on this? Firstly, how worried are you about inflation, and what do you identify as the main causes?
I think go back to, I mean, these problems started late last year with the container freight, and then became semiconductors. You know, these shortages, they were supposed to be sorted out in a few months, and keep pushing it back. Now they think the semiconductor crisis will last at least another 12 months. And in China, I think that's the reason why we have seen a slowdown, moderate slowdown in the Chinese economy during the first 4 months of this year. That's what the petrochemical data shows us. And we're getting this inflation pressure now. We've got the rising value of the yuan, increasing commodity prices, real problem. There's a chance, of course, importing a lot of commodities. So that's an issue for China specifically. And globally, we've got these inflationary pressures building in the United States in particular. I think less so in the EU, where they've got up to 2% inflation. But I think really they're quite glad about that, because it might go somewhere towards dealing with their deflationary problems. But inflation in the US is a major issue. It could be a major issue because of the amount of stimulus they're pumping into the economy. As you say, all these supply chain shortages, it's really complicated. I mean, going to these individual markets, and in some ports in China, the availability of container freight is okay. Other ports, it's not. We've got shutdowns at the Shenzhen port in China for a few days last month because of pandemic. And that's causing more backlog of more container problems globally. So it's complicated. Inflation is a challenge, certainly in the US, certainly in China, probably not as much in the EU. The risk, of course, is that the Fed puts interest rates up, you know, fairly soon, and that affects global growth, or they don't put inflation rates up soon enough, and the inflation then affects global growth. You know, it's a very, very difficult balancing act. I don't think we're on the verge of another great inflation like the 1964 onwards. I don't think we're going to see another period like that. But clearly, those inflationary pressures from supply chain issues are not temporary issues. These are medium-term issues. They're not going to go away because of this enormous disruption to the global economy caused by the pandemic. I mean, the global trade was very finely balanced, very delicately balanced before the pandemic. And we don't know what's going to come around the corner, what the next effect will be on supply chains. Labour markets are interesting. In the US, you've got the problem that because furlough payments are set nationwide, people in poorer rural areas prefer to stay at home than work because they're getting more money from the government. So what they're trying to do is adjust the furlough payments based on local income levels. In the UK, you've got Brexit, which is a problem in terms of immigration falling. People unwilling to go into jobs in certain sectors, say away from hospitality, because they're worried that if there's another lockdown, the new sectors they move into will not be protected by furlough payments. So it's a really complicated world. But clearly, headline risk is US inflation, Chinese inflation represent a risk of higher interest rates, and that will damage chemicals demand, on top of which we've got chemical supply issues. We've had the winter storms. We've got a 60% chance of the US hurricane season being abnormally high, whatever that means these days, and potentially power outages if the summer's really hot in the US. Start to think that some of the supply chain disruptions caused by climate issues is now a permanent factor we've got to consider, you know, extreme weather events. So it's a risk. Clearly, it's how the Fed responds. If they were to raise interest rates, you know, fairly early, it's very bad news for the developing world, because their cost of finance would go up a lot more at a time when the developing world desperately needs more money to deal with COVID.
But John, don't you think these, I'm not at all disagreeing with you on COVID. I think it's absolutely vital, as you say, absolutely right. But all the things you just talked about, just listening to you there, I'm going, why on earth do we want these global supply chains anymore? I mean, you gave us a fantastic list of problems, and they can all be solved if we move away from global supply chains. I just think it's another nail in the coffin of all those supply chains. You want to reshore. If you reshore, you can do it in local money, so you're not affected anymore by the ranking of the dollar or what the Fed does. Why should what the Fed does impact somebody in Malawi? It shouldn't.
We're seeing that with semiconductors, of course, and going back to the issue of semiconductors and Biden suddenly realizing that the US needs 5 nanometer and below semiconductors.
The new CEO of Intel saying, you know, look at the situation. We were 37% of the world semiconductor supply. We're now 12%. How can you be claim to be the world's most advanced economy if you're not making your own semiconductor chips?
Hopefully that kind of long-term thinking will prevail, certainly working in semiconductors. Whether people will change their approach, though, I don't know. They should do.
Yeah.
They should do. Whether they will do is a different question.
Well, I mean, I can see the investors. I mean, what I thought was very interesting, Shell was obviously interested in the courts, but the fact that investors said to ExxonMobil and Shell, look, we're not taking a position on climate change. We're just saying, if you don't now focus on it, we're going to lose our investments. You're being bad managers of what we're doing. You know, look at the share price. It's been going down. And so I think that the financial markets are coming out of their stupor about it's only the next quarter that matters. And people are suddenly realizing that after a few quarters, you're actually into the long term. I thought it was a fantastic list of problems, and I thought one ought to capture that. And it's a kind of list to put on the cubicle wall. You know, anytime I think I want to go back to global supply chains, I look at that list and go, no, I really don't.
Theory. Yeah.
John, Paul and Nigel, thank you very much for joining me this week. And it's very easy to subscribe to our podcast. Just search on ICIS Chemical Podcasts on any podcast app.